Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. Venezuela on the brink of revolution, a newspaper salesman yelled above the noise of the traffic, the honking horns, and the milling people. John bought the paper and stood there for a moment, scanning the lead article. It was about Hugo Chavez, Venezuela's democratically elected anti-American president, and the undercurrent of hatred generated by U.S. policies in Latin America. What about Venezuela? John had watched Venezuela for many years. It was a classic example of a country that rose from rags to riches as a result of oil. It was also a model of the turmoil oil wealth foments, of the disequilibrium between rich and poor, and of a country shamelessly exploited by the corporatocracy. It had become the epitome of a place where old-style economic hitmen, like John, converged with the new-style corporate version. The events John read about in the newspaper that day at Ground Zero were a direct result of the 1998 elections, when the poor and disenfranchised of Venezuela elected Hugo Chavez by a landslide as their president. Chavez immediately instituted drastic measures, taking control of the courts and other institutions, and dissolving the Venezuelan Congress. He denounced the United States for its shameless imperialism, spoke out forcefully against globalization, and introduced a hydrocarbons law that was reminiscent, even in name, to the one Jaime Roldos had brought to Ecuador shortly before his plane went down. The law doubled the royalties charged to foreign oil companies. Then Chavez defied the traditional independence of the state-owned oil company, Petróleos de Venezuela, by replacing its top executives with people loyal to Chavez. Venezuelan oil is crucial to economies around the world. In 2002, the nation was the world's fourth largest oil exporter and the number three supplier to the United States. Petróleos de Venezuela With 40,000 employees and $50 billion a year in sales, provides 80% of the country's export revenue. It is by far the most important factor in Venezuela's economy. By taking over the industry, Chavez had thrust himself onto the world stage as a major player. Many Venezuelans saw this as destiny, the completion of a process that began 80 years earlier. On December 14, 1922, a huge oil blowout had gushed from the earth near Maracaibo. 100,000 barrels of crude sprayed into the air each day for the next 3 days, and this single geologic event changed Venezuela forever. By 1930, the country was the world's largest oil exporter. Venezuelans looked to oil as a solution to all their problems. Oil revenues during the next 40 years enabled Venezuela to evolve from one of the most impoverished nations in the world to one of the wealthiest in Latin America. All of the country's vital statistics improved. Healthcare, education, employment, longevity, and infant survival rates. Businesses prospered. During the 1973 OPEC oil embargo, petroleum prices skyrocketed and Venezuela's national budget quadrupled. The EHMs went to work. The international banks flooded the country with loans that paid for vast infrastructure and industrial projects and for the highest skyscrapers on the continent. Then, in the 1980s, the corporate-style EHMs arrived. It was an ideal opportunity for them to cut their fledgling teeth. The Venezuelan middle class had become sizable and provided a ripe market for a vast array of products, yet there was still a very large poor sector available to labor in the sweatshops and factories. Then the oil prices crashed, and Venezuela could not repay its debts. In 1989, the IMF imposed harsh austerity measures and pressured Caracas to support the corporatocracy in many other ways. Venezuelans reacted violently. Riots killed over 200 people. The illusion of oil as a bottomless source of support was shattered. Between 1978 and 2003, Venezuela's per capita income plummeted by over 40%. As poverty increased, resentment intensified. Polarization resulted, with the middle class pitted against the poor. As so often occurs in countries whose economies depend on oil production, demographics radically shifted. The sinking economy took its toll on the middle class, and many fell into the ranks of the poor. The new demographics set the stage for Chavez and for conflict with Washington. Once in power, the new president took actions that challenged the Bush administration. Just before the September 11 attacks, Washington was considering its options. The EHMs had failed. Was it time to send in the jackals? Then 9/11 changed all priorities. President Bush and his advisors focused on rallying the world community to support U.S. activities in Afghanistan and an invasion of Iraq. On top of that, the U.S. economy was in the middle of a recession. Venezuela was relegated to a back burner. However, it was obvious that at some point Bush and Chavez would come to blows. With Iraqi and other Middle Eastern oil supplies threatened, Washington could not afford to ignore Venezuela for long. Wandering around Ground Zero and Wall Street, meeting the old Afghan man and reading about Chavez's Venezuela brought John to a point he had avoided for many years, and it forced him to take a hard look at the consequences of the things he had done over the past 3 decades. He could not possibly deny the role he had played or the fact that his work as an EHM now affected his daughter's generation in very negative ways. John knew he could no longer postpone taking action to atone for what he had done. He had come clean about his life in a manner that would help people wake up to the fact of corporatocracy and understand why so much of the world hates the United States. And I will come back to this after station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I am speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. John started writing once again, but as he did so, it seemed to him that his story was too old. Somehow, he needed to bring it up to date. He considered traveling to Afghanistan, Iraq, and Venezuela, and writing a contemporary commentary on those three countries. They seemed to embody an irony of current world affairs. Each had undergone traumatic political turmoil and ended up with leaders who left a great deal to be desired: a cruel and despotic Taliban, a psychopathic Saddam, and an economically inept Chavez. Yet, in no case did the corporatocracy respond by attempting to solve the deeper problems of these countries. Rather, the response was simply to undermine leaders who stood in the way of U.S. oil policies. In many respects, Venezuela was the most intriguing case because, while military intervention had already occurred in Afghanistan and appeared inevitable in Iraq, the administration's response to Chavez remained a mystery. As far as John was concerned, the issue was not about whether Chavez was a good leader. It was about Washington's reaction to a leader who stood in the way of the corporatocracy's march to global empire. Before John had time to organize such a trip, however, circumstances once again intervened. His nonprofit work took him to South America several times in 2002. A Venezuelan family, whose businesses were going bankrupt under the Chavez regime, joined one of his trips to the Amazon. They became close friends, and John heard their side of the story. John also met with Latin Americans from the other end of the economic spectrum, who considered Chavez a savior. The events unfolding in Caracas were symptomatic of the world the economic hitmen had created. By December 2002, the situation in both Venezuela and in Iraq reached crisis points. The two countries were evolving into perfect counterpoints for each other. In Iraq, all the subtle efforts, both the EHMs and the Jackals, had failed to force Saddam to comply, and now the U.S. was preparing for the ultimate solution: invasion. In Venezuela, the Bush administration was bringing Kermit Roosevelt's Iranian model into play. As the New York Times reported, quote, "Hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans filled the streets here today to declare their commitment to a national strike, now in its 28th day, to force the ouster of President Hugo Chavez. The strike, joined by an estimated 30,000 oil workers, threatened to wreak havoc on this nation, the world's fifth largest oil producer, for months to come. In recent days, the strike has reached a kind of stalemate. Mr. Chavez is using non-striking workers to try to normalize operation at the state-owned oil company. His opponents, led by a coalition of business and labor leaders, contend, though, that their strike will push the company, and thus the Chavez government, into collapse." That's the end of the quote. This was exactly how the CIA brought down Mossadegh and replaced him with the Shah. The analogy could not have been stronger. It seemed history was uncannily repeating itself 50 years later. 5 decades, and still oil was the driving force. Chavez supporters continued to clash with his opponents. Several people, it was reported, were shot to death, and dozens more were wounded. The next day, John talked with an old friend who for many years had been involved with the Jackals. Like John, his friend had never worked directly for any government, but he had led clandestine operations in many countries. He told John that a private contractor had approached him to foment strikes in Caracas and to bribe military officers, many of whom had been trained at the School of the Americas, to turn against their elected president. He now turned down the offer, but he confided, "The man who took the job knows what he's doing." Oil company executives and Wall Street feared a rise in oil prices and a decline in American inventories. Given the Middle East situation, John knew the Bush administration was doing everything in its power to overthrow Chavez. Then came the news that they had succeeded. Chavez had been ousted. The New York Times took this turn of events as an opportunity to provide a historical perspective and also to identify the man who appeared to play the Kermit Roosevelt role in the contemporary Venezuela. Quote, "The United States supported authoritarian regimes throughout Central and South America during and after the Cold War in defense of its economic and political interests. In tiny Guatemala, the Central Intelligence Agency mounted a coup overthrowing the democratically elected government in 1954, and it backed subsequent right-wing governments against small leftist rebel groups for four decades. Roughly 200,000 civilians died. In Chile, a CIA-supported coup helped put General Augusto Pinochet in power from 1973 to 1990. In Peru, a fragile democratic government is still unraveling the agency's role in a decade of support for the now deposed and disgraced President Alberto Fujimori and his disreputable spy chief, Vladimiro Montesinos. The United States had to invade Panama in 1989 to topple its narco director, Manuel Noriega, who for almost 20 years was a valued informant for American intelligence. And the struggle to mount an unarmed opposition against Nicaragua's leftists in the 1980s by any means necessary, including selling arms to Iran for cold cash, led to indictments against senior Reagan administration officials. Among those investigated back then was Otto J. Reich, a veteran of Latin American struggles. No charges were ever filed against Mr. Reich. He later became United States Ambassador to Venezuela and now serves as Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs by presidential appointment. The fall of Mr. Chavez is a feather in his cap." End quote. If Mr. Reich and the Bush administration were celebrating the coup against Chavez, the party was suddenly cut short. In an amazing turnabout, Chavez regained the upper hand and was back in power less than 72 hours later. Unlike Mossadegh in Iran, Chavez had managed to keep the military on his side, despite all attempts to turn its highest-ranking officers against him. In addition, he had the powerful state oil company on his side. Petróleos de Venezuela defied the thousands of striking workers and made a comeback. Once the dust cleared, Chavez tightened his government's grip on oil company employees, purged the military of the few disloyal officers who had been persuaded to betray him, and forced many of his key opponents out of the country. He demanded 20-year prison terms for two prominent opposition leaders, Washington-connected operatives who had directed the nationwide strike. In the final analysis, the entire sequence of events was a calamity for the Bush administration. As the Los Angeles Times reported, quote, "Bush administration officials acknowledged Tuesday that they had discussed the removal of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez for months with military and civilian leaders from Venezuela. The administration's handling of the abortive coup has come under increasing scrutiny." It was obvious that not only had the EHMs failed, but so had the jackals. Venezuela in 2003 turned out to be very different from Iran in 1953. John wondered if this was a harbinger or simply an anomaly and what Washington would do next. At least for the time being, John believed a serious crisis was averted in Venezuela and Chavez was saved by Saddam Hussein. The Bush administration could not take on Afghanistan, Iraq, and Venezuela all at once. At the moment, it had neither the military muscle nor the political support to do so. John knew, however, that such circumstances could change quickly and that President Chavez was likely to face fierce opposition in the near future. Nonetheless, Venezuela was a reminder that not much had changed in 50 years. accept the outcome, and I'll come back after a station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Venezuela was a classic case. However, as John watched events unfolding there, he was struck by the fact that the truly significant battle lines were being drawn in yet another country. They were significant not because they represented more in terms of dollars or human lives, but because they involved issues that went far beyond the materialistic goals that generally define empires. These battle lines extend beyond the armies of bankers, business executives, and politicians, deep into the soul of modern civilization. And they were being established in a country John had come to know and love, the one where he had first worked as a Peace Corps volunteer, Ecuador. In the years since John first went there in 1968, this tiny country had evolved into the quintessential victim of the corporatocracy. His contemporaries and John and their modern corporate equivalents had managed to bring it to virtual bankruptcy. They loaned it billions of dollars so it could hire U.S. engineering and construction firms to build projects that would help its richest families. As a result, in those three decades, the official poverty level grew from 50% to 70%, under or unemployment increased from 15 to 70%, public debt increased from $240 million to $16 billion, and the share of national resources allocated to the poorest citizens declined from 20% to 6%. Today, Ecuador must devote nearly 50% of its national budget simply to paying off its debt, instead of to helping the millions of citizens who are officially classified as dangerously impoverished. The situation in Ecuador clearly demonstrates that this was not the result of a conspiracy. It was a process that had occurred during both Democratic and Republican administrations, a process that had involved all the major multinational banks, many corporations, and foreign aid missions from a multitude of countries. The United States played the lead role, but the U.S. had not acted alone. During those three decades, thousands of men and women participated in bringing Ecuador to the tenuous position it found itself in at the beginning of the millennium. Some of them, like John, had been aware of what they were doing, but the vast majority had merely performed the tasks they had been taught in business, engineering, and law schools, or had followed the lead of bosses in John's mold, who demonstrated the system by their own greedy example and through rewards and punishments calculated to perpetuate it. Such participants saw the parts they played as benign at worst. In the most optimistic view, they were helping an impoverished nation. Although unconscious, deceived, and in many cases self-deluded, these players were not members of any clandestine conspiracy. Rather, they were the product of a system that promotes the most subtle and effective form of imperialism the world has ever witnessed. No one had to go out and seek men and women who could be bribed or threatened. They had already been recruited by companies, banks, and government agencies. The bribes consisted of salaries, bonuses, pensions, and insurance policies. The threats were based on social mores, peer pressure, and unspoken questions about the future of their children's education. The system had succeeded spectacularly. By the time the new millennium rolled in, Ecuador was thoroughly entrapped. The U.S. had her just as a mafia don has the man whose daughter's wedding and small business he has financed and then refinanced. Like any good mafiosi, the U.S. had taken their time. They could afford to be patient, knowing that beneath Ecuador's rainforests lies a sea of oil, knowing that the proper day would come. That day had already arrived when, in early 2003, John wound his way from Quito to the jungle town of Shell in his Subaru Outback. Chavez had reestablished himself in Venezuela. He had defied George W. Bush and had won. Saddam was standing his ground and was preparing to be invaded. Oil supplies were depleted to their lowest level in nearly three decades, and the prospects of taking more from prime sources looked bleak, and therefore, so did the health of the corporatocracy's balance sheets. An ace in the hole was needed. It was time to cut away Ecuadorian pound of flesh. As John drove past the monster dam on the Pastaza River, he realized that here in Ecuador, the battle was not simply the classic struggle between the rich of the world and the impoverished, between those who exploit and the exploited. These battle lines would ultimately define who we all are as a civilization. The U.S. was posed to force this tiny country to open its Amazon rainforest to U.S. oil companies. The devastation that would result was immeasurable. If the U.S. insisted on collecting the debt, the repercussions would go far beyond abilities to quantify them. It was not just about the destruction of indigenous cultures, human lives, and hundreds of thousands of species of animals, reptiles, fish, insects, and plants, some of which might contain the undiscovered cures to any number of diseases. It was not just that rainforests absorb the deadly greenhouse gases produced by our industries, give off the oxygen that is essential to lives, and seeds the clouds that ultimately create a large percentage of the world's fresh water. It went beyond all the standard arguments made by ecologists for saving such places and reached deep into the soul. If the U.S. pursued this strategy, it would continue an imperialist pattern that had begun long before the Roman Empire. The U.S. decries slavery, but its global empire enslaves more people than the Romans and all the other colonial powers before them. John wondered how the U.S. could execute such a short-sighted policy in Ecuador and still live with its collective conscience. Peering through the window of the Subaru at the deforested slopes in the Andes, an area that during John's Peace Corps days had been lush with tropical growth, he was suddenly surprised by another realization. It dawned on him that this view of Ecuador as a significant battle line was purely personal, that in fact, every country where he had worked, every country with resources coveted by the empire, was equally significant. John had his own attachment to this one, which stemmed from those days back in the late 1960s when he lost his innocence there. However, it was subjective, his personal bias. Though the Ecuadorian rainforests are precious, as are the indigenous people and all the other life forms that inhabit them, they are no more precious than the deserts of Iran and the Bedouins of Yemen's heritage. No more precious than the mountains of Java, the seas off the coast of the Philippines, the steppes of Asia, the savannas of Africa, the forests of North America, the ice caps of the Arctic, or hundreds of other threatened places. Every one of these represents a battle line, and every one of them forces people to search the depths of their individual and collective souls. John was reminded of a statistic that sums it all up. The income ratio of one-fifth of the world's population in the wealthiest countries to the one-fifth in the poorest countries went from 30-1 in 1960 to 74-1 in 1995. And the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the IMF, and the rest of the banks, corporations, and governments involved in international aid continue to tell us that they are doing their jobs, that progress has been made. And I will continue in the next show. Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.